or apparent authority to waive any of the contractual provisions, and two, that Temple Inland did not impliedly waive any of these relevant contractual provisions. And even if they did, waiver is not an independent basis for monetary recovery in this case. Now, first of all, UO Group failed to provide any competent evidence to support their claim that Steve Hospiter had actual or apparent authority to waive the contractual provisions in this case. Actual authority requires some communication from the principal to the agent. It's elementary agency law. Now, it has to be...
Let me interrupt you a minute. The trial court instructed the jury that they could find implied waiver if by a preponderance of the evidence proving that Temple Inland's conduct through the agent Steve Hospodar. Did you object to that?
Well, Your Honor, we objected
to the... Did you object to the jury being told that all it took was the conduct of the project manager to support a finding of implied waiver by Temple Inland?
We objected to the agency, those instructions.
I know you generally objected. Did you object to that particular instruction?
I believe we did, Your Honor. The authority in this case, actual authority, requires a communication from the principal to the agent. And in this case, and it's an intentional act by the principal. And in this case, the evidence as to what Temple Inland's intent was at the time of this project, not projects 2 years before in 2005 or 2006, but Temple Inland's intent during this project on May 3rd, 2007, they had a contractors meeting. 14 different contractors showed up, not just UO Group. Every contractor that was on this job showed up. 10 Temple Inland employees showed up, the plant manager, Sherry Stennett, Bob Dansby, all of these people gave presentations. And what did Temple Inland think on May 3rd, 2007, before this project ever began? They wrote, owner's rep, this is the PowerPoint presentation, owner in his record exhibit number 7 for this court, owner's rep will not be authorized to approve changes in scope of work until he has the approval of maintenance manager Bob Dansby. Any work performed without authorization is done strictly at liability of the contractor. So that was Temple Inland's mindset about what they thought, and that was the communication they gave to Steve Hospiter. That is absolutely zero evidence of actual authority in this case.
Well, there was evidence, it seems to me, that Hospiter indicated, go ahead and do something. The subs did it, and they were paid. Is that any evidence of an implied waiver?
Of an implied waiver?
Yes. The actions not only of Hospiter, but the actions of the corporation in paying based not on a written change order, but on just the word of Hospiter.
Well, no, Your Honor. It goes back again to the authority issue, but in terms of, certainly it was contested as to whether or not he even made these representations.
And, sure, of course. But that the jury could have believed that he did.
Right. But in terms of it being an implied waiver, no. He said, what was actually said was, well, give me your time sheets and we'll get you paid. And why that's important is that this case is different than the Addicts case. And the Addicts case, and we'll discuss it more, this was a time and materials not to exceed contract. And so unlike the Addicts case, which was a fixed price, do the job for $4 million. In this case, for instance, one of the paper machines was bid on for $183,000. What that means is that if UO Group had actually done that work and gotten it finished for $160,000, that's all they'd get paid. The cap becomes important, or the field change orders become particularly important, once they get to the cap. the $183,000. And they have to turn in the invoices, and everything is audited, the timesheets, et cetera, because Temple Inland wants to make sure that they're not going to try and bill us for $183,000 when they only spent $160,000.
Counsel, I'm not sure I am clear on how these purchase orders went, but can you tell me how many scope changes or change orders occurred during the course of this whole construction? Can you tell me how many change orders or scope changes were made with or without approval by Steve? Can you tell me how many in total?
Well, there was no field change orders at all ever executed whatsoever. There were none requested, zero.
I'm not hearing you. I'm sorry.
Okay. And in terms of how many different problems there were with the projects between the
I'm talking about changes from what the purchase order provided for.
It's Temple Inland's position, Your Honor, that there was essentially no changes. I mean, that UO Group was... In terms of scope, UO Group was hired to fix Paper Machine 1 and Paper Machine 2. And
Well, the plaintiffs have proved a certain amount of dollars that they were entitled to recover other than what they were paid under the contracts or purchase orders. So I guess we know about so many change in the scope to support that verdict. You can't tell me how many changes were made from the beginning of the purchase order and the amount to be paid?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the problem is that it's, again, Temple Inland's position that they were hired to fix Paper Machine 1, fix Paper Machine 2, and that under the contract they were supposed to adequately staff, have the appropriate materials and supplies, that they were charged with knowing about the construction diagrams and any subsurface problems, and they didn't do that. And well, this was a massive overage.
Some of the changes were at Steve's own. He wanted more welders, and he didn't pay as much to utilities. Some of these changes was his doing. You can't tell me how many changes were made by at the request of you and done for additional money that you were to owe or less that you were to owe because Steve arranged for it to be done by someone else. You can't tell me how many times that happened on this job?
I can't tell you the exact number of times, Your Honor, no. But again,
the record doesn't show it.
I haven't counted them up, the back and forth. But in terms of, for instance, the additional welders, again, it's our position, Temple Inland's position, that they were supposed to adequately staff this from the beginning. And it's.
Well, can you tell me how many times the contract was provided for and the change and whatever it was documented? Can you tell me how many times that happened?
No, and it was...
It never happened?
It was it's Temple Inland's position that once a request has been made, if Steve Hospiter has the authority to request things be fixed or done correctly, then it's UO Group's responsibility to tell us how much that's going to cost, how many additional man hours...
And get it documented, get it signed.
And get it signed.
Was that done in any one case?
None. Not one. There's not one field change order that was ever...
That's pretty damning to your position, is it? Isn't it that this whole deal was operated on Steve say-so from the beginning to the end and no documentation? Are you telling me that Temple Inland supervisors wouldn't know what was happening if that was done?
They would know, but in terms of getting it additional, if... UO Group felt like this was an additional change beyond the contract. It was their job to provide the information concerning how much it cost, and just like in the Addicts case, get a field change order signed. And it's interesting that you mentioned or requested earlier or discussed the additional welders, because even during the project, I mean, Temple Inland's mindset certainly before this project started was Steve Hosper didn't have authority. But Plaintiff's Exhibit 37, number 2, is an email from Steve Hosper to the plant manager on May 18th saying, I am requesting approval for an emergency purchase order for the Reynolds Industrial Contractors for additional welders. Please give me the approval. So even during this project, Steve Hosper, with other contractors who have said, hey, get us a field change order, he's doing it. This is Plaintiff's own exhibit, 37, page 2. Steve Hosper on May 18th is doing exactly what the procedure was. In terms of his apparent authority, and his,
I need to make sure that this is correct. Is your factual theory that Steve Hosper actions were not inconsistent with the authority that he did, in fact, have?
That is absolutely correct.
He, as a facilitator, that is to say, a facilitator to see that the project is going.
The word that was used in the purchase order is coordinator. The purchase order shall be coordinated through Steve Hosper. And this is just like any, if you're real estate agents between buyer and sellers of homes. I mean, the agent is allowed to say, listen, they want you to paint the bathroom, okay? But they don't have the authority to bind. They can certainly request. They want a new kitchen counter. Whatever the agent, if it's a sports agent, they want, you know, extra jerseys, whatever it is, but they don't have the authority to actually bind the principal or the player or the homeowner in this case. And that's, and you know, in terms of whether he, so to answer your question, right. I mean, he had the authority to request changes, and then they were supposed to tell us how much it was and get a field change order. And he didn't have the actual authority, apparent authority, certainly. I mean, Justice Rivoli, you wrote in 1977 in the Southwest Title case that, from the Texas Supreme Court, that you look at the actions of the principal only in determining apparent authority. You do not look at the actions of that is a communication between the principal and the third party.
That's my difficulty with that charge that I asked you about just a few minutes ago.
That's
the law. It has to come from the principal, not the project manager.
Correct. And
now they've got a finding that he has authority from the principal to waive.
Well, that was one of the questions that they asked the jury.
What is the authority for that?
Well, they asked, one of the questions to the jury was, did he not have authority? And the jury answered yes, and so then that was the second question. But we certainly don't think that he had actual authority, and Temple Inland didn't, and he obviously didn't even in May of when he's writing about,
It seems to me you're hanging out there not on actual authority, but on either implied waiver or apparent authority.
And apparent authority, Your Honor, is, I mean, the fatal evidence to their claim and apparent authority is Steve Hosper's own testimony. Ben Snyder's own testimony. For apparent authority, it's a communication to the third party. And on record page 3960, Ben Snyder testifies as following. Steve Hosper is the only representative that I dealt with through the whole job at Temple Inland. He had no other communication with any, except for the contractors meeting, where he could have asked people, all the phone numbers were up there, but the only communication he had was with Steve Hosper, and Steve Hosper cannot clothe himself with authority at all.
Well, that's the contract, and when we get to waiver, if we're talking about apparent authority, the appearance must come from the principal.
Correct.
The appearance must not come from the agent on the ground.
This court wrote in...
That's a friendly question.
Okay. And I agree completely, Your Honor. And this court actually wrote...
That's very good that you...
I thought this court wrote a very clever sentence in the Cactus Pipe case in 1985, and it said, while agents are often successful in creating an appearance of authority by their own acts and statements, Such an appearance does not create apparent authority.
Mr. LeBoon, I think.
How well stated that is.
Yes, sir.
Genius.
Mr. LeBoon.
Yes, sir.
You need to sit down.
Okay.
You're giving Judge Reveley so much credit here. Mr. Hubert.
May it please the court. Tom Hubert here on behalf of Utilities Optimization Group. I have Mr. D'Amico as the CEO and owner of the company, and with me is Joe Levine and Jane Heidingsfelder. The three of us tried the case together in Beaumont. Obviously, this is a jury trial, and the standard of review is very important in a case like this. The Fifth Circuit's rules on that are that the court should be especially deferential to a jury's verdict in a situation like this, and that only if a court finds that a reasonable jury would not have a legally sufficient basis to find for the non-moving party, can the jury verdict be overruled.
Mr. Hubert, did Temple Inland object to the phraseology of the implied waiver on page 15? Did they object to it or not?
Is it in response to the question that Judge Reveley asked?
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about the instruction. If we look at the record, when we look at the record, are we going to find an objection to that instruction?
Your Honor, I don't recall a specific objection to that, to the language dealing with Mr. Hospodar having the authority. I did just now look in response to your question to find out exactly what Judge Hartfield did state on the record, and your evaluation of the legal aspect of authority is absolutely correct. You look at the party who is being charged with the responsibility to see what their actions were, and this is, I quote, from Judge Hartfield's instructions to the jury, only the acts of the party sought to be charged with responsibility for the conduct of another may be considered in determining whether apparent authority exists.
Well, that's totally inconsistent with the page 15 where it says that the conduct of Temple Inland's conduct through its agent, Hospiter, was unequivocally inconsistent with claiming the right UO Group obtaining written authorization prior to any changes. I mean, it seems to me that's a big issue in this particular case.
Well, in order to get to the waiver issue, you have to find that there was authority. So the first issue is there authority? The first issue presented to the jury was there authority? If the jury came back and said there was no authority, then the next question would never have been asked and never would have been answered. So the next question on waiver would have been completely irrelevant. And that's how the case was presented to the jury. It's how the evidence was presented to the court in general. And it is very consistent with how Judge Hartfield wrote his jury instructions to make sure that there was nothing unclear. Had they said no to authority, they would have returned a verdict in favor of Temple Inland, and the case would have been over, and the next question would not have been asked.
Well, Mr. Hubert, let me ask about that first question. That first question is the one that says, did Hospidor have the actual apparent authority to waive? And then it's fleshed out. Is that what you're saying is the first question? Did he have
Yes.
the apparent or actual authority to waive the following contractual requirements? And then it gets into the written field change order. Is that question number one?
That was question number one.
And that was not objected to, was it not, on basis of its being a proper statement of the law or an improper statement?
I don't believe it was objected to. It was a proper statement of the law, and it was a proper question asked to the jury. And I think, you know, a couple of points that I'd like to make, if I can, just back to the general argument.
Well, let's go back, because
sure.
I understand what the questions are, but it's the instruction underneath that I believe should authority for another to act for a party must arise from the party's agreement that the other act on behalf and for the benefit of that party. If a party so authorizes another to perform an act and the other party is also authorized to do whatever else is proper, usual, and necessary to perform the act expressly authorized, Make sure that this is... One of my questions here is this. It seems to me that Mr. Who do we have? Mr. Hospiter actions as a coordinator could be seen both as being consistent and perhaps even inconsistent with his job. And as a matter of law, is that sufficient? In other words, he tried to help, he tried to coordinate, he tried to do all these things. But as I read both briefs, and this is, I looked for this, there is no evidence that Hospiter says, heck yes, I have authority to do this, and I'm going to do it. He did say, yeah, you know, give me your, you know, give me whatever you need, and go ahead and do it. But he never said that he had the authority. Now, the other aspect of this case that bothers me is all this other stuff. You know, the work orders and the contractors meeting specifically told all the contractors that he would not have that authority. So in other words, this, quote, waiver or apparent authority has to be viewed in the background of what was told to all the contractors from the get-go. This is a kind of unusual case, it seems to me, and it's not as black and white as either side makes it out to be.
Can I address your comments?
Sure, absolutely.
First of all, authority is based on the party's relationship. It's based on parties' undertakings. It's based on the practices of others engaged in the same or similar undertakings. That's the background that you have to look at authority. And it's going to either be expressed or it's going to be implied actual or it's going to be apparent. It's one of those three. So what you have to do, of course, we have to look at what did Temple Inland do to make UO Group believe that Mr. Hospiter had the authority to act in the manner that he did. There is no question, Judge Rievele, that Mr. Hospiter made many, many, many initiated changes, 13 or 14 to my count that he initiated independently, 13 or 14. What did Temple Inland do? They designated Mr. Hospiter as the project manager in the purchase order. They designated him to be the individual who did the request for work, which was sent to UO Group specifically by Mr. Hospiter. Now, what else did they do? They designated the Temple Inland representative in their own purchase of services agreement. And I want to quote this and be very careful to make sure that I'm reading it properly. All services, this is, on, I believe, in the second paragraph of the purchase of services agreement, all services of contractor will be authorized by and coordinated through Temple Inland's representative. That is Temple Inland's statement in their purchase of services agreement. Yeah. Now, what else did they do?
But no, just a minute. Is that consistent with your argument that you didn't need a written change order?
It is consistent.
I mean, it seems to me we're talking about two different things. Did you need, were you told that you needed a written change order?
The written change order requirement is in the purchase order. There is no question about that.
Okay.
However, what Judge Hartfield instructed the jury is that even though those things were not done, they could be waived. They could be waived by the actions of Mr. Hospiter if his actions were unequivocally inconsistent with claiming the right of having something in writing. And if I know you, I've only got 11 more minutes, and I want to make sure I get this point in. There were several previous contracts between the companies. Three out of four changes that were made, two of which were done by Mr. Hospiter orally instructing UO Group to do certain things in the turnaround from the previous year, were paid on a time and material basis in a timesheet with language that was identical to this one. The same thing happened the previous year in 2005 with a different project manager named James Witten. In one case, he chose to use the field change order authorization form. In the other case, he chose not to. And in both instances, Temple Inland decided to make the payments to UO Group despite not having those forms in their files or ever even done. They were waived in all three of those instances of the four that I just named.
Mr. Hubert, those were separate contracts. Tell me, what point of relevance was that evidence introduced to prove?
What form of relevance was it introduced to prove?
What issue that was before the court was that evidence relevant to?
That was introduced to prove two things. One, the authority of Mr. Hospodar.
Well, just a minute. I don't understand. If you have a contract, how do you prove the consistency or inconsistency by the consistency or inconsistency of prior contracts? Now, I was thinking about this. It could be rebuttal type evidence. You know, we've never done this, and then you show how you've done it. But it seems to me that you've used that as primary evidence to show this apparent authority that you're trying to show. And I'm not sure I don't understand how that came in.
Well, first of all, some of the evidence was let in because Temple Inland, in their opening statement, they opened the door to other contracts through arguing or stating to the jury that there was evidence of other contracts that were not similar to this or something like that. I can't recall the exact words, but Judge Hartfield specifically said, you opened the door, these things are going in.
Okay.
That's one thing that happened during the trial. But they are important because it shows that Temple Inland allowed for Mr. Hospodar to act exactly the same way in 2006 that UO Group is claiming he acted in 2007. And Temple Inland's actions, that's the action of the party charged with responsibility, followed through and made payments to UO Group for the changes that did not have field change authorization forms. Now, how do we get to
what happened? Did you make any type of allegations of perhaps custom or practice of the corporation let this evidence in?
There were allegations of customs and practices. The Judge Hartfield did not allow anything in other than what dealt specifically with Mr. Hospodar, and that was that I think our exhibit number 43. In exhibit number 43, there was 13 different contracts that Mr. Hospodar was project manager on. This is the whole issue of 2,900 pages of contracts, and not one time, even where there were changes in prices and changes in scope, did Mr. Hospodar fill out a change order authorization form. Not once.
Did all 13 of those involve your client?
No, those 13 involved different clients, but UO Group was involved in the group in the production of documents. So we did have other examples that specifically dealt with UO Group. These examples had identical language. The PO orders had identical language that you had to get a field change order authorization form filled out in order to have an approved additional amount of pay. And yet, in each case, what Mr. Hospodar did, rather than fill those forms out, is he just entered it into the computer system, and then ultimately it was paid. In this case, I think it's very important.
I mean, we had this contract that was explained by opposing counsel of how it was priced. Were each of these changes paid in full? Was there a retainage of some sort and all to be made up at the end of the contract?
For each of the 13 other contracts, we didn't get any.
Not other contracts. Each of these alleged, you were being misled by Hospodar as this matter was going along. And Judge Garza had asked opposing counsel earlier about among the activities where these apparently were paid without the written authorizations. Were these interim payments in full for the changes?
I don't believe there were any interim payments. And all I can do is speak on behalf of what happened with UO Group.
Were there no payments at all until the end?
Pardon me?
Were there no payments at all until the end?
In this case, yes, no payments until the end for the contracts involved in 2007. I do want to make a point about the change orders itself. The very first time that Mr. Hospodar instructed UO Group to buy materials that were outside of what it was supposed to buy, he had a conversation with Ben Snyder. And during that conversation, Ben Snyder specifically asked, are you going to fill out a change order form? And Mr. Hospodar said, yes, I'm going to do it, and he never did it. It's just, and there's a note across the invoice that was ultimately presented to Temple Inland for payment, and that's how Mr. Snyder, was Mr. Snyder's handwriting, and that's how he explained what happened. In each and every other case after that, that Mr. Hospodar instructed Ben Snyder and or someone else with UO Group to do things, they told him they were changes, and this is all evidence that the jury heard. He was instructed, as UO Group was required to do, these are changes, how do you want to handle it? And Mr. Hospodar's response was, just keep giving me your daily timesheets, and I will, and that you'll get paid on that basis. Now, there's specific testimony that the jury had the right to accept and believe Mr. Snyder over Mr. Hospodar, that that's exactly what he intended to do, and that they expected to be paid for any of the additional work. Now, there was no question anywhere at this trial that there were delays, that there were extra issues that required extra work. I mean, he went so far as to tell UO Group, buy a $6,000 drill bit, which they did at his instruction, and that is certainly a change. Mr. Hospodar agreed that he made many, many changes to the scope of the original agreement. He testified to it, and he also said in his testimony that he did not always follow the change order procedure. Those were his words. When I questioned him on cross-examination and reminded him of his testimony and his deposition, he agreed that he did not always follow that format.
Well, Mr. Hubert, let me ask, I mean, the exchange earlier about whether it's enough for the agent itself to be claiming this authority. The definition given by the judge to the jury on apparent authority is that the party, which is Temple Inland in this case, must knowingly permit another to hold himself out as having the authority or through lack of ordinary care seemingly bestow this. What is your position of what the evidence really supports, that Temple Inland did enough, insofar as the evidence going to the jury, to support that Hospodar, for all the things he was doing, actually had the authority to be doing this? What did Temple Inland do? Did they do something? Did you have any evidence that they knowingly permitted, that they were aware that these things were going on in this case or in some of these other 13? Or were they showing a lack of ordinary care that they would have been aware of this?
I believe that they knew exactly what was going on.
Not what you knew. What's in the evidence that
they
knew?
The evidence is in the purchase of services agreement. They assigned Mr. Hospodar as the person who had authority to require work to be done. That's one. And the material request, the request for material that Mr. Snyder received, there is a CC to Helen Gibson, who's in the purchase. She's the purchasing manager with the company. And she certainly was aware that he was instructing UO Group to do something outside of the scope of the agreement, because it was materials that Temple Inland was required to buy that they then required UO Group to buy. So it's not as if he's acting completely on his own. He certainly sent an email to Thomas Sweetser about the Reynolds Welding Group.
They have known that these change orders were not being done?
Without any change order being done, he did it. And frankly, they want the good and the bad. I mean, they want it both ways. Reynolds Welding, that's a change to the original contract. You know what ultimately happened? They reduced what UO Group was to be paid, $22,500, and he never filled out a change order for that. He never got anyone at UO Group to sign and accept that as something that should have been done. So in that situation, they want to take advantage, but they don't want to live by their own word or by Mr. Hospodar's word and lack of filling out these forms.
Mr. Hubert, you've got a judgment of almost $300,000. How many scope changes did that represent?
Per scope change, what is that worth?
How many change orders from the contract agreement did you prove in order to recover almost $300,000?
I think we proved all 14 of them. We counted 14, up 14, and all were proven.
14 change orders represented by all of this much money.
That's right. And there's also issue about what do you do when there are delays not caused by UO Group, which is in their proposal, and the jury had the right to believe that any delays that weren't caused by them should be paid. What happened, Your Honor, is once we got into extra work, The request for a quotation specifically then refers you to a quote, to the rates. UO Group provided its rates, and there's also language in there that deals with materials as well. And then from there, you look at the time and material contract procedures, which are also referenced in the purchase order to determine how you're paid. Mr. Hospodar reverted essentially from the not-to-exceed contract to a time material contract for all of the additional work that they did and for all the delays that occurred. The invoices were presented, the daily timesheets were presented and signed by Mr. Hospodar every single day. Had he had a problem with it, he could have said, this is not correct, or he could have easily said, guys, you're not getting paid any more than what the contract says. You can keep handing these in, that's fine, but that doesn't mean we're going to be paying you for this extra work. And what's very interesting is Mr. Hospodar struck through a couple of people at the very end of the project, well after they had gone way beyond the number of hours. And if those timesheets meant nothing, then why would he strike through a couple of people that were working?
Is what procedure you just described, is that inconsistent with the contract itself?
No, sir, it's not inconsistent, because had the change order procedure been followed by Mr. Hospodar, and by the way, he testified that it was his responsibility to fill out that form. That was his testimony. And that's what UO Group expected. Now, had he followed it, then given the type of delays that were occurring, there would have been no way anyone could have predicted just how much extra time or how much extra cost would have been incurred in this turnaround situation, and they would have had to go to a time and material type of contract. But rather than him fill out those forms, he just did it on his own, and he did it with the authority that Temple Inland conferred upon him as the project manager through all the other things that we've mentioned in our brief.
Mr. Hubert, you're talking, and your time is up. Is there any other question?
No.
Great. You may sit down.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. LeBoon.
I wanted to first address something Mr. Hubert said, which I believe is a mischaracterization of Ben Snyder's testimony concerning the piping that was originally requested, and him writing, and this was Plaintiff's Exhibit 9. He did, in fact, write up here field change order from Steve, but you can look at the record very carefully, and this is on pages 4034, 4036, and 4037. He testified, Mr. Snyder testified, he never sent this invoice to Steve Hospodar. He wrote this as a note to himself, a memo to himself, get a field change order. But look at the testimony, look what he said. He never sent this invoice until, he never sent it to Hospodar. Now, there's certainly, in this case, again, no, first I think it needs to be pointed out to the court that the trial court actually found that UO Group breached this contract, that it was their responsibility. Every single witness that got on the stand from UO Group and Temple Inland agreed it was UO Group's responsibility to secure the field change order, and the trial court found that as a matter of law and instructed the jury that UO Group had breached this contract, period, paragraph, and that has not been appealed. UO Group breached this contract, and everybody found it, and they agree. They didn't modify it. There was no pleading of modification, no pleading of promissory estoppel or quantum merit in this case, unlike the Addicts case again. In terms of apparent authority, it is crystal clear that Mr. Hospodar cannot clothe himself without authority, and that is black letter Texas law, Fifth Circuit law, and that is the only, Ben Snyder testified, the only person I ever talked to was Steve Hospodar.
Well, isn't it also true under Texas law, this instruction I was talking about earlier, that apparent authority exists if Temple Inland knowingly permitted this to happen or through lack of ordinary care bestowed on Hospodar indications of authority? And if that is proper statement of Texas law, isn't there some evidence that Temple Inland knew this was happening?
Absolutely. In this case, Your Honor, I think what we need to look at is May 3rd, 2007. The previous contracts were a red herring in this case, and you know, the fact that there weren't field change orders in there is irrelevant. There weren't timesheets. You can look through Plaintiff's Exhibit 43. There weren't timesheets either. Those things were thrown away when the contracts were done. And in this case, May 3rd, 2007, Temple Inland's mindset to themselves and everybody else is Steve Hospodar does not have authority. Go get it from Bob Dansby. He has to get it from Bob Dansby. That is what they told every single contractor, not just UO Group. That was what Temple Inland's management is. They're all sitting there putting on this presentation.
Okay, you're talking about the presentation. We're all accepting that. The jury apparently didn't. And I'm wondering if one of the reasons they didn't is that there's some evidence that Temple Inland was aware of how Hospidor was operating thereafter.
Thereafter, what the only evidence we see in this record is, for instance, the Reynolds email from May 18th, where he's writing Tom Sweester, Bob Dansby's boss, the entire plant manager, saying, please get me an emergency purchase order. They have no evidence in this case for the UO Group that Steve Hospidor or that Temple Inland knew he was acting with outside the scope. And quite frankly, Temple Inland doesn't think he was acting outside the scope. He had the authority to request they do this project right, that it be manned correctly, and had the proper materials, et cetera. So they didn't think that any of this was out of scope. I mean, getting the drill bit, the drill bit was bad. Okay, they needed, and they were charged, and the court says it, UO Group were charged with knowing about any substructure problems.
Is it your position from what you just said? It seems to me you're saying the Hospidor acted completely correctly, and it's solely UO Group's fault for reading into that, that they didn't thereafter also need to be submitting these change orders. Well, I mean, if somebody from Temple Inland was sitting alongside Hospidor, are you saying there's nothing that representative would have been required to correct or to state in order?
I think if I understand your question correctly, everything that Steve Hospidor was requesting that they do was to get this project done. And for UO Group to think, for instance, we talked about the drill bit earlier, I mean, nowhere, the timesheets are in the exhibits. Nowhere on there did Ben Snyder ever write down on the proposition that timesheets will get you paid, and that was his assumption and his testimony trains from trial, is ludicrous when you look at the fact of the timesheets that part of plaintiff's exhibits. Ben Snyder never wrote down any of these materials, these extra materials that they requested. That is not diligence on his part. Ben Snyder never asked anybody any questions.
Mr. Bloom, thank you very much. Just a minute.
Go ahead. Let me say something to counsel in this case and suggest that you relay it to your clients. This happens all the time. Owners have to put something into the contract if it's going to be a substantial contract. And then you have all of these change orders, and people on the ground haven't got time for all this red tape and bureaucracy and documentation, and they say go ahead, and they do it, go ahead. Now, one thing that I'm going to do, and perhaps the court will do, is protect the provisions that owners are entitled to put into their contracts. At the same time, I haven't read the record, and I don't know what's going on between you, but these are two responsible companies. And Arthur Temple's company, Temple Inland, I was once offered the job as general counsel for Arthur Temple a long time ago. I had to move my office to Diboll, but that's all right. This has got nothing to do with my decision in this case. At the same time, Temple Inland can hardly justify what they owe by saying, well, no matter what happened, now we got you on your contract. If there's ever a case that ought to be settled, it is this one. And I'm going to ask our settlement people to contact you, see what you can do about it, because I want to suggest that this case may have to be retried or may be decided the other way. I don't know. I really can't say. But I am convinced, at least from what little I know, that it would be in the interest of both parties to resolve this case amicably. Thank you.
All that said, you know, we will proceed with this case, and whatever the record shows, shows. If both sides want to proceed, you have every right to proceed. Otherwise, the panel will make a decision on the record and the law and the facts of this particular case. We will be in recess.